We're back, fellow timekeepers, and we have a packed agenda. The headline act is in conversation with none on the other, Charles Till, I'm sure many of you know. He's here to talk about the life and drama of an auctioneer, how an auction gets curated and executed, a few funny stories along the way, and how listeners can and should participate in an auction. Charles will also discuss the latest venture with Lion and Term Auction House and its inaugural London watch auction. Tim's never been to a watch auction before, so he's chomping at it a bit. We've also got our usual patter, watches we're lusting after, Insta shots of the month, now replete with the winner receiving one of our bear mats, as well as a look at a Grand Seiko and their one-of-a-kind watch dials. There might also be an imminent new watch alert, so stay tuned. Tim, how have you been? And welcome to the show, Charles.
Yeah, no, I've been good. Thanks very much. Obviously, the weather's been atrocious. So I know, Charlie, you're going to be on an airplane tomorrow. So hopefully it's fair flying for you. But no, I've been good. And I may have a small new watch alert to mention. But other than that, I'm really good. What about you, Charlie?
We're really good here. Very busy. A terrible time to go on holiday, I've got to admit, because the auction I put together for November 21st closes soon. But I really feel like a bit of sunshine, a bit of rest could bring me back recharged. So I go to Greece tomorrow morning very early.
Oh, wow. Brilliant. Like I said, hopefully have a smooth flight. So we'll do wrist checks. So Zach, what are you wearing on your wrist today?
So today I have on a gold 1980s vintage Hamilton automatic. How about yourself?
Nice one. There's a certain watch I'm going to mention very shortly, and that's been on my wrist all week and I haven't taken it off. But for the show, I've got my trusty Black Bay 58. It's getting more near autumn. I think it's quite an autumn watch. I put a leather strap on it the other day as well. Took it off the NATO. So, feeling good. What about you, Charlie?
So obviously, with going away on holiday, I switched out the usual wear and put on the Tudor. It's the Heritage, the Black Bay Heritage Dark, which was the first kind of PVD coated one they did. Then they discontinued it and placed it with the ceramic. But personally, I much prefer this version because it has the red depth and it has the red triangle. I find the ceramic version a little monotone. But it's kind of like my beach watch.
Oh, good. Good man. I do like a good NATO. And I do like the orange, the red triangles. That's really good. So we're gonna do a section called Latest Releases. Now, as you know, this podcast, we distinguish ourselves from others by not reporting on the latest news. We're not a news service. Other podcasts do it far better and are fully plugged into the industry. We're nothing but mere enthusiasts. But that said, there are some releases that you sort of make you stop dead in your tracks, and you just have to comment on them. And there was actually two from September. So the first one is Baltic, and it's the Prismic Stone Dial range. And oh my God, I do love a good stone dial. There's 1970s pieces from Piaget, for example, incredible. And I was lucky enough to get one in the lapis dial. So that's lapis blue. They've got three of them. One is, like I said, the lapis. The other is in a jade, and there's another orange dial, which is incredible. And it was there was 200 each, so I was lucky enough to be one of those 200. Slightly humorous story. My son, as a few people know, just started school, and his pickups at 3:15, and the watch went on sale at 3 p.m. French time. So I was basically late picking him up because I had to get one of these watches. But no one said anything, which is fine. But I was definitely running, and you've got to prioritize watches over other things, don't you? But like I said, just couldn't wait for it to arrive. It arrived really, really quick. Great customer service from them. And I mean, I like the jade version almost as much. I need to find someone who actually owns the jade one and see it in the flesh. But Zach, I think you like the orange one, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the orange one because originally it'd be coral, but not anymore.
No, I don't think it's coral. I'm not too sure. I think we're going to have to, maybe we'll send you a link to it, but it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, I think you prefer that one, don't you, Zach? Whereas I think I'm more taken by the jade and the lapis.
Yeah, I think I definitely do prefer the kind of orange agate kind of star one. I feel like it contrasts super well, but they're all pretty good in my opinion.
And they come with this wonderful Milanese strap. I'm not a big fan of straps, as listeners know, but I did want to try this one out. And it's just beautiful. And I think, like I said, you can't go wrong with all three of them, really. But another one that stood out was a brand, again, I don't own, but I'd love to at some point. And it's Fears, and it's called the Brunswick, and it's a jump hour. Like stone dials, jump hours are incredible for vintage. It's got an allure for me. So when they released their special edition in a purple, I think last year or the year before, It was just calling. I was waiting for them to do it in other colours, and they have. It was a blessing from the watch gods. And they haven't done it with just one. They've done it with three colours. So there's a jet black sunburst dial, which, again, I think is incredible. It makes it pop even more. There's a coral version, which, again, is pinky orange, which I'm not the biggest fan of, but I know others, you know, Zach, like yourself, might like. And the final colour is a deep sea green, which I'm quite partial to with my green dial infatuation. What do you think of the Brunswick and the Baltic? Does it do it for you? And do you like the jump hour?
First of all, congratulations on your blue dial, Tim. Thank you. Great option, definitely, for sure. It's definitely a gorgeous watch. As you mentioned, the blue dial, I believe, is like top notch. But the agate orange version is my favourite choice, maybe because it probably contrasts better in terms of all the dial colours if I was to wear it. I can say I'm not the most familiar when it comes to Baltic watches, but I have stumbled across a few of their salmon dial watches. I think they're Mr. Classic, Mr. Roulette models on my Insta Explore page. And I do think they look stunning. And at £450, that is a bit of a steal, I'd say, when it comes to watches. Also, the like kind of Breguet style numerals I've also found very alluring, as well as their 36 millimeter profiles. And Fizz is a brand that first came to my attention from speaking to a watch friend, James from Kibble Watches on Insta. It's always intriguing to hear about like family owned brands, especially British watchmaking brands. They've got an incredible history that spans from as far as 1800s, which is amazing. And also, when it comes to the Brunswick, their kind of latest edition, the Brunswick Jump Hour, I feel like it's a great looking watch with an impressive level of complexity. I love the homage to vintage design with its cushion shaped case and onion shaped crown. The hand polished lacquered dials spread across two layers are very aesthetically pleasing, in my opinion, and the color options are perfect. The JJ01 movement is really fascinating to me, and it's an impressive element to the watch, as well as it being aesthetically pleasing. The movement is also top-notch. The price point is significantly higher than the Baltic, so that's something to note.
Just a bit.
Yeah, just to note. But that's understandable, given the difference in offerings when it comes to its movement and other materials used.
Wonderful. So I think we'll move over to watches we're lusting after. So Charles, we'll bring you in at the end so you can have a bit of a think about, you know, what's the watch that you really want more than anything in the world right now. But I think, Zach, you're up first, aren't you?
Yeah, I am indeed. So for me, funnily enough, we kind of mentioned it before. It's the Baltic Prismic, which we've been speaking about, but not the blue on this occasion, the orange. So Tim does have the blue. And definitely influence a potential next purchase for me. But after seeing his new purchase of the blue dial, that made me even more interested in looking at the alternative colours. The orange variant definitely captured my attention in a different way.
Cool. No, again, I'm not going to complain about that, am I? It's a beautiful watch. I think if someone's selling them now, they'll probably be double or treble in price. That's the problem when it's only 200 copies. But yeah, so for me, I could have gone for the Baltic Stone Dial, could have gone for the Fears we just touched upon. But if I'm allowed a deviation from those two, it's going to be a small new brand called Bernerot, and it's called the Mirage. And you've guessed it, it's in a lapis blue. For those that don't know the brand and the watchmaker, it's basically a love letter to the Cartier crash. So you've got the swirling case, you've got the twisting hands, and sort of the offset sub-dial. It's Dali-esque, you know, it's a work of art. It's incredible. And the case back as well is like an artist's canvas, you know, similar flowing lines to demarcate the innards of the watch. And someone that puts a premium on aesthetics like me, head over heels with this watch. It's expensive, but it's cheaper than a crash, put it that way. Charlie, what about you? If you've got something that you really, really want more than anything at the moment?
Well, in all honesty, to Tim and Zach, I think I always have a list of watches that I want. It never really changes.
You've got to pick one.
It just deviates. I've just got to pick one. Well, I mean, I could never just pick one. But there is a model which I've always kind of lusted after. I doubt I'll be able to get any more. So I'm a big, obviously, vintage guy. And I go very much for the classics. So I'm a huge Submariner fan. And I've always loved the, you know, the early 1970s, the 5512 Submariner, which is the same model that Steve McQueen wore. Basically, it was the chronometer rated. They made two, the 5512, 5513, very similar. The 1-2 was the chronometer rated version. And the 5513, really, they made for the American market so that it had less taxation coming in. The problem is, we've all known that the 5512 is a much smaller production run. So, but its price is not massively higher than the cheaper version of 5513. But Nick Fawkes has just released a book on the Submariner, and Rolex, for the first time, it's in association with Rolex. They've actually released production numbers. And that means that I will never be able to buy a 5512 Submariner because now it turns out. So the higher production, the 5513, they made like 151,000 of them. And the 5512, which is the one that I want, they made just over 17,000. So, you know, by comparison, I think we're going to see a massive price jump in the rarer version, which means I'll never be able to afford it. But I still lust after it.
Well, if the auction, if the auction does very well,
very, very we will live in hope. But there's always tons of modern and vintage pieces that I always want.
No, exactly. Maybe we should bring what you're lusting over vintage and what you're lusting after modern. So there we go. Brilliant. So we're going to turn to the Insta shots of the week that I really enjoy. I think it's my favourite part of the episode. And I can never pick one, so I always end up picking three. So we'll just go from the top. So it's a gentleman called Watchby, and he's got his black FXD, and he's doing a wrist check in front of a desert. And it's got sort of this wonderful, like I said, sandy background. Excellent color contrast with the black and sort of the creamy sand. It's something out of like the Mummy movies, if you remember those from the early 2000s. I've not come across many desert shots or watch shots on Instagram. Beaches, yes. I've done it myself on Western Supermare's Muddy Beach. Never done it anywhere that exotic. I think it's a very beautiful shot. And then we've got another one from Martin Senek, and it's a beautiful vintage duo of the Universal Genève Data Compacts. White dial on one side, the rarer black one on the other, and the background's this original sort of advert for both watches. And I love vintage UG, as many people know, and it looks simply stunning. And it's got all the important symmetry with the four sub-dials and the distinct sort of gorgeous golden hands. So that's my second one. And then finally for me, shout out to Mar Powell 88. You know, I couldn't have this month without a Nomos, because our last episode was obviously the deep dive on that brand. It's got some nice, you know, quality shots and watch props. He doesn't like a bit of like mooring rope in the background as well. It's really cool. An old map, and he's got a vintage globe there as well. So it's old school perfection for me. It's a good set with neat macros in there too, with the matte black dial and the red second hand sub dial. I think they're really good. So Zach, if you're going to award one of our wonderful beer mats, which one do you like the most, and which watch shots have you got of this month as well?
I kind of feel like they're all pretty good shots this time round, but I'd have to say the black FXD, which is interesting because you're both wearing Tudors at the moment. So the black FXD by Watchby, I kind of feel like the location just elevates the image completely. Like you mentioned, haven't really seen one with such an exotic background, and I kind of feel the color of the watch really pops against that background. So yeah, definitely say the black FXD rather. My favorite Insta shot of this month goes to Watchworks Haarlem, vintage watch retailer based in the Netherlands. They featured Cartier's 1993 tank, Cartier tank Basculant, which was influenced by Cartier's original Louis Cartier design. And they managed to capture this watch chic design and complex, almost rotating or flipping mechanism that's captured at each stage throughout the shots. The shots capture the Basculant's ability to not only look incredible, but serves as a multifunctional watch when flipped, which is pretty cool. So a big shout out to them.
Brilliant. And now we're going to get to like the meat of the episode that I've been looking forward to for months. And that is the interview, with Charlie. So I'm going to do a little bit about, obviously, the company you work for. And then I'm going to ask the first question and then obviously throw it over to Zach to ask the others. So, Lion & Turbo, one of the longest established fine art and antiques auction houses in the UK, obviously originating in Scotland and in London, been doing so since 1826. I'm sure, Charlie, you'll do even more of an intro to yourself and the business as well. But let's just start with the questions that we shared with you a bit earlier. So tell us about your career and how you've come to work for Lion in Turnbull Auction House.
Awesome. Cheers. Thanks so much, Tim and Zach, first of all, for having me on here. I don't know if you know, but so I started in this business in 1990. I started in London with a specialist vintage and antique watch store called Somewhere Antiques. And that's really how I started learning. So that's why my specialization has always really been vintage and antique pieces. From there, I moved into the auction world for Bonhams and then set up Bonhams Watch Department in America. Jumped from there to Antiquorum, first of all in California, then New York. It was then transferred to run Antiquorum Hong Kong, then to Sotheby's. Sotheby's was quite a big change for me, really. I think sort of with this huge corporate company. And I don't know if I was really the best fit for them in terms of sort of, you know, interdepartmental issues. And there was some things going on there I didn't enjoy. So finished with Sotheby's, became a consultant, and mostly over in America, really, for the last kind of decade, I suppose, really building collections for people and advising collectors. So I came back from America to the UK fairly recently to kind of restart again doing consulting work, but then got introduced to Lion Turnbull, and although vowing that I wouldn't go back into that corporate auction world after my experience, met them, really got on with them, really liked their kind of ethos. And it's a much more family kind of based system where, you know, everyone is very driven, but everyone is also driven to working together and to doing better things together rather than kind of forcing us all against each other. It's very much kind of built up as one, which I really like about it. I really like the people. So I was really happy to join them. And it's funny actually how it came to me, because it's a bit cheeky, really. A friend of mine actually was offered the job and then came to me and said, do you think I should, what do you think, you know, basically they want to start up a watch department. They haven't had watch auction before. What do you think? And I said, look, you know, I haven't been in it for all that long. And I've done this before with Bonhams. It's really hard, you know, to try and sort of bring a department together or an auction together when you haven't done one before. I know how much work goes into it. And I remember the following morning, I kind of woke up and I was like, you know what? I mean, I quite fancy doing that. I mean, I should do it. So then, but I called my friend and said, you know what? I don't want to do it, but I think I might go for the job. And he said, yeah, like, you know, obviously, to do it. And that's how it all sort of came about, really, which is quite serendipitous.
No, wonderful. That's an amazing story, an amazing life as well. I'm very, very jealous. I'm sure you've got lots of other stories that you tell after a few drinks as well. But Zach, over to you for the next question.
Sure. So can you explain how a watch gets curated for the auction? And you've mentioned previously there are a number of stages.
Yeah, of course. So it is quite straightforward in terms of what's the simplest way to do? Obviously, well, there's two ways, really. Either we receive an email from someone that says, you know, just found this watch, don't know anything about it. Can you tell me about it and give me an idea of value, etc. We also deal with collectors as well, and people that obviously have built over the years and then decide they want to try and release onto the market. And a lot of the work that I do is going to kind of do these valuation events where I'll go and meet people, and often not, they'll just bring along a watch and say, you know, does it have any value? Can you tell me anything about it? And that's for me, the best thing, because you just never know what you are going to see. And I've found some phenomenal watches from exactly that scenario. And the predominant number of pieces, as it's the inaugural auction coming up in November, are from just single owner watches. I mean, I have a wonderful 1968 Jaeger Kutcher, basically a diving chronograph, from the guy that got given it for his 20th birthday in 1968. His parents bought it for him in Zurich. And I'm like, you know, are you sure you want to sell it? But obviously, I'm encouraging him as well at the same time. And for me, the great thing about it really is finding these pieces. So obviously, in that scenario, we look at the watch, I give him a current market value. I will also then advise kind of, you know, how previous prices and how prices are going forwards. For me, I always like to be upfront as possible. If they don't sell today, there's more chance that they're going to sell with me tomorrow if I am forthright and honest with them. And once we agree an estimate and a reserve, then a contract gets signed, goes into the auction. And in fact, we'll use that Jaeger chronograph as an example. So it has an estimate of £6,000 to £8,000. Now, the reserve is the minimum amount that it can sell for. It can't legally be higher than the low estimate. So a reserve in that scenario can be £6,000 or less, but can't be higher for obvious legal reasons. And then we catalogue it, consign it, research it, photograph it, promote it. And then in one day, in this case on November 21st, once we've done all the promotion for it, we then try and find the person that's going to basically pay the most amount of money for it. Now, because the watch market is a global market, because we have a very much an international and global client base, we don't know who's going to buy that watch and whereabouts they're going to be. We obviously have targeted collectors that we go to. But overall, because the watch market now is so huge, we just don't know. And that's a great thing about it.
It's fascinating. Nice. Yeah. So are there any sort of, there must be some challenges you face in the auctioneer role. You know, what about beforehand, on the day and perhaps afterwards as well? You know, is there buyer remorse, for example? But I'm quite keen to those three stages. Before, are there any sort of concerns, challenges on the day? What's that like? And then afterwards as well?
Well, I think, in any business, huge amount of challenges. And beforehand, really, there's numerous. You can imagine the way that you work, you're bringing in all the watches almost on a daily basis. Now, all those watches have to be fully researched. They have to be catalogued. They have to have a footnote where it's relevant. They have to be photographed. And then you have to produce a catalogue while you're also trying to build the collection at the same time. So the troubles beforehand really is time and just trying to get everything done by that catalogue deadline. And again, the researching. So quite often I'll come across something which is just incredibly rare. Again, in this sale, I've got it's a Chinese market pocket watch made around 1820 by William Ilbury, London. It's a really important piece. And there's just a phenomenal amount of research that goes into bringing that to the market. To ensure the originality of the piece, and so that you maximize its exposure. You never really want to undersell it, anything. So research, a lot of research, endless research. So during, I was actually, the day of the sale for me is generally the most fun. So I would usually auctioneer the sale. I've done it quite a bit before, and I expect for this one I will also do. And that's when a little bit of pressure comes off in terms of you've done all your promotion, you've tried to find your buyers as much as possible. And then it's a bit of a relaxing day where, you get up on that podium and see the results. Obviously, there can be real highs to it. And I've seen auctioneers have a terrible time when there's real lows to it. If you have a very low sell-through rate in terms of all these pieces you've worked so hard for that you're not finding buyers for, it's a very emotional thing to do, really. But for me, I really love being up there and enjoy it very much. And then kind of post, you generally, because it's been built up so much, you have a bit of a kind of quiet moment often afterwards. Everyone says, you go out party. You don't, but more often than not, because you've just exerted yourself that much with the energy, it's quite nice to have a bit of a relaxing moment. And then for all the kind of the issues post, that's largely held by the accounts department. There are obviously issues where someone in Timbuktu bid for something, and then legal has to chase them down for payment, etc. And we don't often get, and when you say buyer's remorse, it's a legally binding contract. If you bid in the sale, you have to pay the price. So we don't get buyer's remorse in terms of someone saying, whoops. Because basically, if you were the winning bidder, then you denied someone else the chance to bid. So it is a legally binding contract. But there is always minor issues with shipping or things like that, but I have to be honest with you, they're not generally the things, unless I'm asked to, I get involved with so much. From a logistics point of view, that's where the kind of the Lyon and Turnbull cogs all turn into action and do the work, unless of course someone will come along sometimes and pick it up and say, how do I wind it, which has happened before.
I was going to ask, is it a little bit like the Chancellor's Exchequer when they do their budget? You allowed a little tipple, you allowed a little drink while you do it, or do you have to be stone cold sober if you're an auctioneer?
Actually, I think Gary, it might be one of your questions on here. I'm not entirely sure, but I'll tell it anyway. No, basically, I don't. I drink a massive amount of caffeine because there's so many numbers going through all the time. Then I really have to stay focused on it. But interestingly, you say that the first auction Legally, I wasn't quite the auctioneer. I was waiting for my New York auctioneer's license. So I, Your Honour, I was not the one with the gavel, but I was the one doing all the talking. And it was a charity auction. And now, it was my first charity auction. They're way more casual. Normally when you auction in, you know, it's quite a sort of staid thing, although I prefer having conversations with people. But in the charity ones, you can make it a bit more fun. So I was walking around chatting with everyone, trying to get them to bid, and everyone had drinks. And I was like, well, I mean, why haven't I got a drink? So that was actually fantastic, because then I could just mingle with the crowd to try and get the bidding to go up. But again, from a legal point of view, I was not the auctioneer because I did not put the hammer down. But that's the only time I
did it work? Did it work?
Good. And actually, and again, one of the great fun things in that, so I'd put the catalogue together, and it was for a charity, and they were all like special edition pieces. And there was one that was fantastic and didn't have any bids coming in. So I remember standing there, and it was a lot of it was online as well. And I was looking at the camera, I was like, you know what, auctioneer, I'd like to bid for this one. So then it became, you know, like a bid pieces of me taking the bids against the online bidders. It was basically just, so this watch, you know, made the money really deserve to make. Great fun.
Nice. So I think I've got a follow-on question that's similar to this.
Yeah, I do indeed. So what you kind of touched on the kind of feels while you're doing the live auction. Is there any other kind of feeling rather than having you kind of mentioned as to mentioning loads of numbers that come into mind? Is there a particular feeling that you feel whilst kind of running that auction?
Yeah, I mean, obviously adrenaline going through, and really, you know, we're in a very professional business here. So my main concern is on behalf of the buyers and sellers, and not to let down the buyers and sellers. But on the other side of that, for people that haven't followed auctions, if you are the auctioneer, you are in control of that room. So you know, we do not take a situation of people questioning your judgment. You have to, it's a bit like being a judge, basically. Well, when you are up there, you are the one that makes that final decision. What if you make the wrong decision? So my main thing up there is just trying to focus as much as possible to always make the right decision. And it's funny, I can see now, and there's I won't bring them up actually, but there's a few notable ones, very famous ones that I've watched online, where the auctioneer is just phenomenal. And you can see how he's going with the bidding, and you can see the process and the waiting and the encouragement. And then you can see him make a mistake. And you know, and I really feel for them anytime you make a mistake like that. So our main thing is don't make mistakes. You know, get them.
So it's like taking a penalty for England then as well.
Yeah.
You step up and you don't miss. You don't miss. You bring it home.
Hopefully not as many people watching. Or maybe as many people
watching. Very good. So the next question is, so why should a watch enthusiast participate in a watch auction? You know, I've never done it before. I've always gone on like Chrono 24. I've gone into a shop and I've bought a watch. You know, why should I go to a watch auction and do it?
It's way more fun. I think really for the auction, yeah, everyone should go. Every watch enthusiast should go to an auction preview, because that's how you will learn the most about watches at any time. And I think you should also go to a watch auction, because again, that's the most that you'll learn at any one time. And to give you a quick idea, so what's the best way to try and explain it? So in America, they have a lot of estate sales, where basically someone passed away, and then all the items that they have, a bit like, you know, he didn't pass away, but the Newman Foundation that came up, or the Newman sale, I think last year, the year before. And the reason that they go to auctions is because that is a market value. So someone can say to come to me and say, look, I've seen XYZ watch on Chrono 24. They're asking £35,000. Now, does that mean that watch is worth £35,000? Or is that just a dealer overpaid for it, or a private seller is underselling it? But when you go to an auction, that the amount that watch achieves, or any item or whatever it might be, is the market value. And that's why, again, from a legal point of view, estate sales always go to auction, because then you know that you achieve market value. And so from when you're looking, from an outsider looking in, you can see how the market is doing. Is the market very strong? Are the prices going very high? Is the market weak? Are the prices going low? You can see variations between you know, let's say in the vintage world anyway, you can have two watches, very, very similar, but one just more pristine than the other. And it can take, you can make five times as much money very easily because someone wants that pristine example. So you learn so much in terms of, you know, it when it sells for that much more, you say, well, why? And then you look through the catalog and you ask your friends and you go through notes and say, actually, you know what? That was just a much nicer watch. And then it, you learn so much from it going forwards. So yeah, I think absolutely everyone should go and view sales and go and look and hold the pieces and see. You just learn so much more about it. And then to participate, just so you can understand at the kind of like the public level where the market is and how prices are achieved. And it's a great event.
Oh, I'm going to have to do that at some point soon then. I mean, I suppose maybe a poorer man's example is, I suppose, trying to buy a car. You know, if there's a nice Porsche that you like or something, you don't always get the cheapest one because there might be something under the hood that's wrong with it, I guess. So, but some, you know, you see 911 and you think, oh, that's beautiful. I can just about afford it. And then you see another one that's, you know, treble the price. But yeah.
The other thing too, to Tim, just to say for the auctions, one of the, for me, something I really try and do and something which everyone should be encouraged to as a buyer, is we have to produce condition reports. So in that instance of the Porsche, then rather than you just looking at it and saying, I wonder if it's a good buy, I wonder if it's not a good buy, and we'll you know, transfer that into an old Rolex, then you can check the condition report and it should, you know, this is where you really have to trust the person that's writing it and go with their experience as well. We have to say, you know, watch is working, watch is not working, dial is original, dial isn't original, flaws with it. Our sort of general opinion on it. And that's how you tend to find that the more experienced people in the industry, it's not so much anymore now because it's grown so much, but it used to be that, you know, there was a very small number of us that was kind of, you know, moved between different companies and clients would follow you because they trust your judgment. And if you say that it's a really beautiful piece, then they knew that it was a really beautiful piece.
That sounds like it's a safer way to buy a watch then than other things you could do it. Zach, have you got the next question?
Yeah, I do indeed. So how easy is it for watch enthusiasts to go to auctions and what do they need to do exactly?
You have to walk up to the door and press a button. No, it's incredibly easy. So if you want to go and see a preview, and this applies to all the auction houses, you just have to bring along ID. We ID everyone and make a note of their ID, obviously from a security point of view. But anyone can just walk in and see it. And then again, turning up to the auction, because there's no watches on view, you don't even need to have your ID with you. You can just literally walk in, sit down. If you want to bid, then you have to have an account number and get a paddle. And again, remember, this is not The Simpsons where Bart's bidding away. It's a legally binding contract. If you raise that paddle, you have bought that watch. And for instance, and you'll see, if someone goes off to the bathroom to go get a cup of coffee, they will take their paddle with them because that paddle is you know, your credit card. You leave it on the seat. Someone comes up, raises it. Well, you just bought a watch. No matter what you say about whoops, like that is your responsibility.
Wow. No, it's good to say that it's easy because, again, when you say, you know, big auction houses, you say their names out loud, you know, it sounds quite intimidating. But if you can just, like, you know, walk up, you know, obviously you've got your credit cards, you get your paddle, get registered. So maybe it's like a bit of like a taboo that, you know, people need to break, you know, as watch enthusiasts that might not always or have never bought a watch from a watch auction before.
No, it's very straightforward. And the only thing as a piece of advice I would say is set yourself a limit. Because the easiest thing to do is we'll make up numbers. Let's say something's estimated £5,000 to £7,000. And you'll say, you know, I would pay £7,000 for that. And then it gets to seven and you're like, well, maybe I'll pay eight. And then someone else bids 8.5. You know what? Nine. And they bid 9.5. And now, you know what? I really want it. I'm not going to let them get it. 10, 11, 12. And then afterwards, it would, like you say, with the buyer's remorse and where they just say, wait a minute. Yeah. I shouldn't have paid that much money. So go in with a number, write it down even, rather than just having it in your head and say, I will not go beyond that number. And that's, I think, the majority of first-time buyers that I see just get carried away with it. So that would be my one piece of advice. Set yourself a number, don't go over it. And just as a quick story with it, I think I was like 16 or something. When I first started, I was sent down to to go to a really big auction, and they said, stand at the back, you know, raise the paddle, bid up to this much money. And I'll never forget my first time ever bidding in a room, and it was a packed room, and I raised my paddle and said, okay, you know, at the back, and I think I had to bid up to like £10,000. Said, at the back at 7,000. And I looked around and I was like, is it me or is it someone else? Like, did he take my bid or did he take someone else's bid? And he's like, okay, going to sell at the back at 7,000. And I started to panic and I raised my paddle. And he says, young man, the bid is with you. And the entire room turned around to look at me of like, you know, who is this novice sitting in the room? I felt like, you know, an interview. But that was my very first experience as a buyer into it.
Very good, very good. I suppose if you do spend too much or go beyond your limit, I don't know if they take organs or something if you try and sell them. So try and make the money up. But,
yeah. No, they don't.
I think the next question was sort of similar. It's about what one piece of advice would you give someone going to a watch auction for the first time? But if you're saying it's keep a price in your head, I suppose it's a bit like going to a casino. If you've got a number in mind, make sure you stick to it. But are there any others?
Yes, ask questions and ask a lot of questions. You know, when you have a specialist there, they are there to assist you in that sort of sense. And so never feel embarrassed about, you know, well, I don't want to ask, and everyone always says to me, it might be a stupid question, but there are no stupid questions. Ask anyway. I mean, we're all very sort of personal in this business. And you know, ask other people as well. I mean, get like a very view of it. But most importantly, if you're unsure, just go and ask. Find the specialist. That's what they're there for. And say, you know, is it a good example? Is it not? What do you think I should pay? That's another really good one. I mean, sometimes we will put a watch in below its market value to encourage bidding for it. And so, you know, if something's estimated at 3,000 to 5,000 and realistically it's going to make a lot more than that, again, and it's your first time buyer, go and say, you know, what do you think it's going to make? Because then, you know, we'll be very honest and say it's going to make 3,000 to 5,000. Or we're going to say, look, in all honesty, it came in at quite a reasonable estimate, and you're probably going to have to bid higher. But we are there to provide advice for people.
Brilliant. All good tips. Zach, I think you're up with the next question.
Yeah. Are there any common mistakes you see bidders make during auctions? I know you kind of mentioned to treat your paddle, keep your paddle close to your chest.
And certainly not that I've seen. Bidding on the wrong lot, that has happened, I've seen. Or, you know, and I've seen too, in immensely rare situations, people get upset where, I said before, you know, the auctioneer is he's the one in charge. And normally we'll bid in set increments, roughly kind of, you know, 10%. At different auctions are different ways, in different countries are different ways. But where people will try and split those increments, or basically try and override or confuse the auctioneer. Or just, you know, it's just not a very good way of going about. You know, so again, if it's, you know, 10,000, 11,000, 12,000, 13,000, they'll try and make it a bid 10,100. And the auctioneer is like, no. You know, so if they do it once or twice, or if it's in an entertaining way, it's okay. But if they do it repeatedly, I think that's just, you know, unprofessional, bad manners. And they will normally be the very experienced buyers that do it. And they're doing it a little bit to confuse the auction or to slow the auction down. That personally, I find a little frustrating. But first-time buyers don't tend to do it.
That's fascinating. So do you, just moving on a little bit more towards yourself, you know, do you have a highlight of your career thus far that sort of just stuck out? And maybe you've got many stories, but if you have to pick like one or maybe two.
Yes, many. Let's try and think. I'll pick two, you know. I'll pick two. So the first one was, and just I think it's a really interesting story. Actually, there's quite a lot, you know, Tim. When I was over in America, first of all, to give you an idea of when it was and the age, it was a compact disc with some watches on it. And one of those watches, it's a Rolex, I know you guys don't like references. Anyway, it's a reference 8171. It's a triple calendar moon face that Rolex made. They made two different versions, a Precision and an Oyster, from the sort of 1950s period. And when I received it, I called them straight away. And I think, I put it in at, I think the standard estimate at the time, again, gives you an idea of when it was $30,000 to $50,000, in fact. So I wrote out my proposal at $30,000 to $50,000, put it in the mail, And I went back and looked at my computer screen, and just this watch was so phenomenal. The condition was so nice. It was so beautiful. I was like, I mean, it just can't be right. It can't be genuine because it's too clean. So I ran back, increased my estimate, and I won the contract. I won the watch. And in fact, so he had sent it to all of the big auction houses, and they had all quoted 30 to 50, and I had quoted more. And so I won it. And that watch, I think, again, at the time, sold for just over $200,000, to give you a quick idea. And that was one of the first kind of like really epic watches that I found in America. But one that, I mean, had been known for a couple, but I guess the other one was, I'm going to miss the reference. It was unique. It was a 2419. It's a Patek Philippe. I think it was 1950, retailed by Cartier. Patek Philippe minute repeating wristwatch, unknown to the market. No one had ever seen anything like it. It changed all the rules, basically, on what minute repeaters looked like from Patek Philippe. And that was just a really beautiful one to be able to bring to the market and to research. And how did that? To give you a quick idea, we've got the Patek Philippe produced what's called an extract from the archives, which tells you when it was delivered, basically. And I think, I can't remember the exact date, but let's say it was delivered on like May 30th, 1950. So to try and research this thing, I just spent countless hours and days and weeks and almost months to try and find another example. And I went through a book by a buddy of mine called John Reardon, and he had written a book advertising in America. And this was, I think, 3 o'clock in the morning at my apartment in New York. The books were piled up everywhere. And I came across an advert for a Patek Philippe Cartier exhibition, and it was 30th of May, 1949. And then I remembered, well, wait a minute. I mean, what are the chances that this watch was delivered to the client to the day 1 year later? And then found out, I contacted Cartier, and in fact, Cartier had sold that watch, which then increased the value. So that was a really big one I was quite proud of. But there have been, or there was stainless steel, like the 1436. Anyway. Lots and lots and lots.
That's incredible.
Next, we do have a question that's probably slightly similar. So what has been the most memorable watch auction you've conducted and why?
I mean, they've all been good from so many points of view. Has there been any kind of real standout watches? No, I mean, for me, someone years ago, I did an interview and someone said, What's your favorite restaurant and why? And my answer in that situation was, you know, I never remember the food that I eat and the ambience of the restaurant. I remember the people around me. And so my memory of the most enjoyable auctions that I've had depends on, you know, the people in the room and the ambience at the time and you know, the conversations that go around it rather than any sort of particular watch that was sold.
That's still a good answer. I like it.
Yeah.
So a question that Zach thought of, but I really, really liked it. And it was about technology sort of influencing the future of, you know, watch auctions. Obviously, this is going to be online. But I mean, you know, I'd be interested to hear your views about where you think that technology is going for the future of watch auctions.
Well, I'm really hoping, and to be honest with you, it doesn't seem to be going this way. So I'm hoping that it'll change. I'm a really big advocate for being open. I think, you know, the open information and I think the transparency in the market, and this conversation I recently with someone where with social media and with databases and information nowadays, I think for people to try and mislead in that sort of sense is almost become a thing of the past, because someone is going to say, hey, you know, you're wrong. And so I think technology not necessarily changing the auction platform, you know, the way that the auction platforms, either with a live auctioneer or bidding as a time sale online, but both work very well. Personally, I really like having a live auctioneer up there, but I can see the pros to both. But for me, I would like technology to be able to bring in a more, I wouldn't say level playing field, but I think a more openness in terms of the history of the watch. Has it appeared before? I mean, it'd be wonderful to have a piece come up and then have another screen to say, this watch has never appeared at auction before. This watch has appeared 5 times, 10 times. You know, it was sold on Chrono 24 2 years ago, 10 years ago, last week. That type of traceable information into watches. which really, you know, should be there. And we see it a lot with cars. So there's no reason. Everything is very much documented. But in all honesty, we're not necessarily going in that direction. We still see major auction houses, which I will not name, not putting the case numbers in the auction, which if there's no case number in there, realistically, how do you identify the what? There should be a case number in absolutely everything. And and I don't think we're going that way, but it would be really nice for the whole auction world and the watch world in general, to be honest with you, if we could sort of go into more of that transparency and even having the brands themselves, you know, supporting it. I know there are a lot of brands that do support the watch that come after auction and should really be supporting the whole secondary market, really to try and stamp out fakes, et cetera, as well, and outside the auction side of things, in the secondary market, but to try and make it as open as possible.
No, it's a good answer, but I suppose, is there a worry of sort of disinformation, a lie's got its, you know, halfway around the world before truth's got its boots on kind of thing? You know, I suppose with the rise of technology, there's perhaps a potential that other people may say something is truthful, enough people agree or think they agree, and actually it's fake news.
Yes, exactly. And hit the nail on the head, Rick. I mean, this is one of the, it is a big problem with the social media aspect of it, where you can get, and this is a real life situation, where you can get someone with a large number of followers, which is just promoting fake news of things as if they know what they're saying. And realistically, that they don't at all. But the people that are listening also don't know. The one benefit I kind of feel for my role, that it will never be taken over by AI, because for my limited knowledge of AI, it's basically taking information that is available online and then sifting through it and then promoting that back again, or you know, once they kind of verbalized it all and then sifted through. But there's so much misinformation out there, which is just absolute rubbish that people have made up, that AI doesn't know what's real and what's not real. So I have pretty good job security.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everyone goes to a watch auction then to get the truth. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well,
Zach, you're up.
Yep. Next question. So where do you see the kind of auction world heading over the next few years?
I can see it kind of condensing in terms of it with the advent of online auctions. It's exploded in the sense that now everyone's an auctioneer and everyone can set up an auction house and everyone can say they're a watch expert and sell a watch. And that, again, has led to a lot of misinformation where I don't necessarily think it's always good for the business from that point of view. But, you know, if we go back to the previous recessions and changes in the market, A, from like 1992, and then, we missed one in 2001, obviously, and then the big one in 2008, and it was kind of in the late 1990s, it changed a bit too. And it's kind of sifted through the also-rans and the want-to-be players in it. And so I can see the whole market kind of condensing where maybe some of these smaller auction houses that aren't employing people that do the research that should go into it, you know, not competing as much. And so we'll probably find it more centralized. And I think that as I could go back to it, as people demand more transparency in it and more frank information and genuine information from the specialist, then I can see changes in the marketplace where the best people rise up and the people that don't provide that type of transparency are left behind.
No, that's a good answer. For me, I'm quite interested in sort of what the age profile for people buying watches in an auction. You know, I have this sort of assumption that it's people sort of 70, 80, 90, dare I say 100. And linked to that, are you finding ways of encouraging a younger audience? You know, and do taste change, or actually, pardon the pun, some tastes are actually timeless. So it doesn't matter what age you are. If it's a beautiful watch, then obviously beauty wins out.
You wouldn't believe how young the bidders are nowadays. Yeah. I mean, there was such a huge range of age in buyers, but you know, I think the last watch in the top lot in the last auction that I sold was to a guy in early 20s, and so yeah, I mean, there really isn't any definition anymore of who the buyer will be. We just don't know, and I like the fact that younger generation are coming in. And have their own style and their own kind of ideas of what they want to buy, and they're not copying any other generation. So yeah, it's a really amazing.
Is that online?
And they'll bid in line and they'll bid in person. So okay. Predominantly, yes, I think they're more online because that's what they're used to. That's what, you know, they feel very comfortable with, where some of the old generation wants to be there in the room. But not necessarily. I've seen, you know, very young guys and girls in the room raising a paddle, and it's great to see them doing it.
No, definitely. Yes, yeah, so in my mind, it's someone who's a bit older, tweed jacket, you know, bow tie, that kind of thing. But if you're saying it's a younger audience with a hoodie and jeans or something, then that's pretty cool.
Definitely not the tweed jackets. They did not exist in this style. No, not generally, no. No, it's a much younger. Much more hoodies.
I think I have the next question. You kind of touched on it already, but so would you say are auctions getting more diverse in terms of representation, and how can this grow if not?
I mean, I think really in society overall, it's becoming more diverse and with more representation across, you know, all boards. So yeah, what we're seeing it from a collector's point of view. I have no stereotypical collector from that point of view. They are all generations, male, female. It doesn't matter. All religions, and I don't see any type of sort of absolute basis. I think it's grown and it will continue to grow, and that's one of the great things about the watch market in general. And I think one of the reasons it's become so popular is that there isn't any sort of. It's a very international market, so it's not necessarily restricted by its geographic location or. Again, by whether it's a guy or a girl bidding or the age that they're bidding, it's so universal in that sense. I think that's why it's appealed.
No, brilliant. That sounds really, really good. And hopefully that continues as well. So can you tell us a bit more about the auction you've got coming up planned in November? So this is your chance to do a bit of a sell about, you know, why people should come along and sign up and that kind of thing. Give you the floor.
Thank you so much. So at the moment, it's not actually closed yet, I have to say. It doesn't close for another few weeks, hence the reason my holiday is such bad timing. But it's not going to be a huge sale. It's probably going to have around 100 lots in it. But again, following on from my passion, it's a very diverse sale. It's something that, to be honest, I'm quite proud of in terms of it has got a really nice selection of quite rare pocket watches, a very big selection of original owner vintage, and some of them just phenomenal condition. And some incredibly sensibly priced modern watches. In the sense, it has something for everyone. Although it's not a huge sale, it's not going to have any world records in there. It's a really diverse sale, and I think it has appeal for a lot of different people.
Wonderful. No, thanks for that, Charlie. And I think, Zach, you round us off with a few quickfire questions you've got planned.
Yeah, well, you kind of touched on this one before. Favorite watch ever?
So I tell you, actually, one that I had in my collection, which I absolutely loved. And once, I don't know how you put it in the right sort of wording. Once I used in my 30s, I had quite a big watch collection. And this was my favorite watch. And once I sold it, I'd never sold any watches. Once I sold this one watch, it was like a floodgate. I thought, I'll never sell it. And then I just started selling them all. And it was, there was a guy I was introduced to in Los Angeles called Matt Stone. He was the ex-editor of Motor Trend magazine, and he wrote a book called Winning, based on Paul Newman and or Paul Newman's cars, and on McQueen's machines, based on Steve McQueen's cars as well. And he had interviewed both Steve McQueen and Paul Newman, and he had interviewed Paul Newman in 1980, I think it was, and he was wearing his 6263 Drive Very Slowly Me Daytona. It's like the big red Daytona. And so Matt Stone had gone out and bought one, and he had kept this watch and worn it quite regularly. He had the boxing papers with it, bought it in 1981. When I met him, I was so in awe. He was such a character and such a fantastic personality. And I said, look, if you ever want to sell your watch, I want to buy it. So one day he phoned me and said, look, I'm going to retire from Motor Trend. You know, do you want the watch? And I bought it, and I wore that watch for a while. And I really loved the whole story behind it as well, because I'd known that Matt, who had written these fantastic books, it was his watch. And when I sold that, that was kind of like the beginning of the end, really. And it's only funny from what was it? And you're going to have to really excuse my accent, because it will not work. But I was in Geneva recently, and I'm sitting down next to this very big Italian collector. And you'll have to, everyone, all your listeners have to excuse me on this one. But it's like, "Hey, Charlie, you are a vintage guy, no?" I said, "Yeah, like, yeah, I am. Why? Hey, so why are you wearing this modern piece of detrimental comment thrown in there about my modern Rolex watch?" And I'm like, "You know what? You're right. Like, why am I wearing a modern watch? I should be wearing a vintage watch." So I go back to Geneva, now having wearing a really super cool vintage watch. So I'm walking around, and then someone, a friend of mine, comes up to me and says, "Hey, Charlie, what are you wearing?" So I show him, and then I explain to him, you know, why I love it and all the different the rarities about it. He says, "How much is it, Charlie?" I said, "Oh, it's not for sale. It took me absolutely ages to find. I've been looking out for this thing for ages." So what do you pay for it then? They pay £8,000. "Oh, I'll give you 8.5. Sold. And that's the that's why I don't own any vintage watches. Because for me, it sounds as it never used to be, but it just got to a point where it was a commodity. And, you know, if someone comes along and I make a little bit of money, I sell it. And then I spend years trying to find another one. And then I finally find one and someone says, "Oh, I'll buy it." And I'm so, you know, I just sell it. Whereas the modern one,
you're doing the hard work for them. And I suppose the final one to round it out, what is the brand that you love the most? You said you loved vintage, but you must have a favorite brand if I were to put you on the spot.
Yeah, well, Tim and Zach, I think I know that a lot of the younger generation are anti, but I love Rolex. I mean, I can really see, I'm a huge fan of Rolex, and I don't think that people are necessarily correct in their judgment of being unable to buy the modern pieces, etc. And I think actually it's been a bit of a detriment for Rolex in that sense. They haven't had the stock to be able to supply demand. But from a modern watch point of view, they produce such a phenomenal value for money, well thought out watch across the board. And then from a vintage point of view, I've met so many original owners for, you know, that owned Submariners or Sea Dwellers in the 70s or Daytonas in the 70s. And everyone I've met has been such a phenomenal character that you just want to sit at a bar and listen to. And that's why I think I appreciate them so much from that point of view. They might have lost their way a little bit in terms of they were very much a sports model produced for a purpose. And now they're a bit of a desk watch produced for, you know, showing off. But from a simple brand point of view, I respect them immensely.
No, definitely. I think I like my vintage Rolex, you know, bubble backs and that kind of thing. But the more modern ones, I'm not the biggest fan, am I, Zach?
So,
yeah. There we go. Each to their own. We're going to move on to sort of the last bit of the show, which is obviously our brand appreciation. We'll bring Charlie in as well for some views. And this time round, it's a Grand Seiko. So we move away from Europe and we go to Japan. I got mixed feelings of the brand. I've never really been interested in them before, like other enthusiasts are. But I think, Zach, you're a fan, aren't you? So, you know, what do you like about them?
Well, Grand Seiko, there's a few things that I kind of like. I'm a big fan of them. I haven't yet owned one, unfortunately, but I do find that they're kind of a bit more on the conservative side when it comes to their design. But I would say I'm more inclined to their subtle take too, rather than some of the flashier luxury brands in the industry. Some other things that kind of impress me about Grand Seiko is their exceptional accuracy when it comes to their watches and their drive to innovate. For example, the spring drive movement that combines the most desirable elements of both mechanical and the quartz watch movements.
Like, this pod is about what we love. So while I find Grand Seiko in terms of design quite samey with little variants, like Zach was saying, they do have unparalleled dial colours and effects. So therefore, I'm going to keep my comments about more about the colours and the dial than reeling off sort of, you know, models and reference numbers. So people that know me, you know, I do love a good green dial, courtesy of my Oris Big Crown pointed 8. So a year ago, I came across sort of a trio of sort of special editions, and I'm going to, you said you butchered the Italian, but I'm going to probably going to butcher the Japanese, which is probably worse, but it's the Gembe Valley, the special editions. And I'm just going to read out the blurb they have, because I could never emulate the blurb they put on their website. So it's within the middle part of the Awai River, the Gembe Valley, a lush ravine formed by the ash of Mount Kuriuma and flowing waters of the Awai River. Boast a multicolour foliage in the fall and snowscapes in the winter, cherry blossoms in the spring and azaleas in the summer. So there we go. So it's three different types of green. There's like a bluey green, there's a turquoise one, finally a light green. And that's almost pistachio, a bit like the Breitling Premier that I fell hard for. So for me, it's the latter dial, that sort of, you know, pistachio green that's my favourite lot. And it's got blue steeled hands as well, which I really like. They're only US editions, so they can be quite hard to source in Europe. And there's a style of it as well. So it's called Kirizuri, which translates as sparkling painting in from Japanese to English. I wouldn't really call it sparkling. It's more like shimmering water. And I suppose a bit like metallic paint. They also come without a date window, so that preserves the symmetry, because I do love good symmetry. And I just think that ruins the aesthetic with the date window, and I think a lot of Grand Secos do have that, but this one doesn't have it. But Zach, which of the greens do you like the most?
I'd say I like the reference SGBW 273, as the green is quite calming to me and subtle, and I feel like it contrasts quite well with the darker leather straps they have on offer with it.
Cool. And I think sticking with the green theme, there's one, again, going to butcher the Japanese, Boyakoa Summer. It's called Flow of Seasons, SBGW 285. It's sort of a darker forest green. Again, it's a clean dial without a date window. You could fall in the deep colour. It's very lush and verdant. Equally, the price isn't bad, considering what you're getting in terms of dial quality. Also Grand Seiko claims sort of the colours signify the end of summer, sort of, you know, early autumn. And it's a neat segue to a new watch that's going to come out in November. And it's a gorgeous sort of burnt orange dial. It's kind of autumn all rolled up into a watch. And the brand call it the morning glow of the Hoitaka Peaks. I've no idea where they are, but it probably sounds very beautiful. There's sort of reddy orange foliage. And the design of the dial is different from the Kirizuri shimmer. It's almost sort of like, I'm going to call it duck feathers, sort of nestled together. I can't wait to see it in person. I think Zach and I are going to have to go to Grand Seiko soon and check these out. But the price is nearly double of that from the Gembe River. So we might have to save up on that. But Zach, what are your thoughts? And perhaps Charlie as well will bring you in. What do you think about the Grand Seiko dials?
Yeah, definitely saving up. That makes sense, given the cost of the watch. But as you mentioned, I think that the autumn dial on the morning glow of Hotako Peaks is truly gorgeous. It's not a watch that I had seen before, before you had shown me it. I love the reference to the peaks, as I feel like it intertwines with the identity of the watch and the brand with its aesthetics. And I love the different shades you get as you glare across the dial. And I may have to take my comment back about it being conservative of design, because these dial colours are truly unique and vibrant.
Cool. What about you, Charlie? Do many people in watch auctions like Grand Seikos? Or do you like them?
Well, I've never owned one. There was one that I really liked two years ago, the Spring Dive Movement, which was Prospects, the dive watch, rather than the Grand Seiko. But in fact, they've just stopped producing it. They've now discontinued it. But yeah, I think in terms of value for money-wise, the people that I know that have been out to the factory and had a look around rate it, you know, as clean and as pristine as, you know, the Patek Philippe's of the world. So I think, again, value for money-wise, and I love this idea that they're bringing in probably quite small productions as well, I imagine, with these various variation colour dials. And if they are, I'm assuming that from your description, making them seasonal as well, I think it's great that we're going to keep seeing changes going through. And I think for any company, to kind of rather than sit down and say, all right, we'll just keep producing a blue dial or a black dial or whatever it might be, and make it set to keep changing it, and particularly with the seasons as well. I think it shows that they're thinking about what people are looking for. They're trying to always innovate, and they're trying to come up with new ideas all the time. So, and I'm a bit like with you, I really love the blue dials. And I think it just looks completely different on these watches. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of them. Don't yet really appear from a collectible point of view at the auctions, but you know, it's still relatively early days. You know, Grand Seiko having from memory anyway, haven't really been re-released all that long. Certainly, I haven't seen their boutiques around for very long. So I think it's still something which is growing.
And I think with four seasons, it means you have to buy four watches. So maybe that's the selling point as well. You can't just have one. You've got to get all the seasons. Yeah. And just touching upon another one as well that I really liked. So it's called the Snowscape High Beat 44GS. It's a stunning silver dial. Again, the narrative of seasons is strong. It says it's the snowscape of Mount Awate, and the snow melts at the end of winter. And I think, again, I think they're just trying to say you need something for winter, autumn, summer and spring. It's a moneymaker for them. I mean, Zach, do you like the silver dial? Are there any others that you particularly like and wanted to share, you know, with our listeners as well? Any other colours, dials?
I feel like this model, the Snowbeat, is a key example for me why Grand Seiko are, how Grand Seiko are getting it right. Everything about this watch is a win for me, personally. I love that from the open back case to the case size for me. It being slightly smaller on the 36mm, the polished case, and most of all, its dial color, which I feel like replicates the Japanese snowy mountains very well. They've definitely smashed it with the design of this watch. I love the navy croc strap that's paired with it also.
Wonderful. So there you have it. We did a little foray into Grand Seiko. Would I buy one? I think the temptation is sort of certainly there, especially my love of dials over other, you know, bits of watches. But, you know, I'm more of sort of, you know, the hands guy on balance, you know, so I like, you know, I like some of the numerals as well, sort of it's pushed. I think there needs to be something a little bit more than just the dial for the higher range models. However, you know, they're unrivaled in their quality, as Charlie said. It's strange for a company which is very conservative on everything else about a watch. They swing for the fence on the colours. I guess it's their USP to differentiate itself from a pat market, particularly one that's European dominated. You know, I do really like that one they're going to release in November with the orange dial. So we're going to have to go in and look, aren't we? But I mean, Zach, if you had the funds, you know, would you take a punt or a pick on Grand Seiko?
Definitely. I mean, that snowscape, I think, is truly incredible. And I've always been interested in Grand Seiko since the Elegance Skyflake automatic spring drive came out. So yeah, I'm always looking at their new releases, and I definitely would take a punt on the snowscape one of the other seasons. How about you, Charlie?
You know, so actually, just your both your sort of comments maybe think about a little bit about it. You know, when we go back to kind of the 1990s, it was very much about case design and about unusual kind of aesthetics from that point of view. And then really for the last, you know, kind of 20 years, pretty much, complications and sports watches have completely dominated the market in terms of their demand and popularity. And I can really see, certainly over the last kind of couple of years, smaller case designs, like you were saying, Zach, with the 36 millimeter case, and moving away from those kind of sports into a more elegant, either a very kind of professional looking bracelet or a leather strap, going more for colors, simplicity, like you were saying, Tim, with the balance as well. I think that's how the market is moving. I can really see more and more people following exactly what appeals to both of you. I think it is going to become, and certainly it has become more widespread in terms of the piece that appeal. And I think that's, you know, these what companies are seeing that as well.
No, brilliant. Thanks, Charlie. Well, that's what brings us to the end of the episode. So there you have it. We had a huge episode this month. You know, highlight was obviously Charlie, you know, here with us to talk about his fascinating career. Those interested in viewing the Lion & Turnbull first online auction, you know where to go and you know what to do. Is it the 21st or 22nd of November, Charlie?
It's the 21st of November. The auction, the catalogue, which I have a new idea for trying to present the catalogue. We'll have to see how my idea works out, but I'm trying. Should be, providing I give up sleep and just work endlessly, out online around November the 2nd.
Oh, wonderful. So nice. Definitely watch this space. And all this talk of beautiful dials, you know, Zach and I, we're going to have to go to Grand Seiko and see it in the flesh. Let's do that soon. And again, with me, I'll be posting wall to wall of the Baltic macros with the lapis dial over at WatchWord. But if you fancy a break from looking at all my watches, obviously you've got Zach at Source Watches. And if you want to listen to a back catalogue, then obviously check out Timekeepers 2024. And next time out, we're going to do a deep dive of a brand that I've personally been keeping back, you know, from the pod, you know, when we started nearly a year ago. I love this brand so much. I've got two models in my collection, and you've guessed it. It's the jewel of the crown of the watchmaking community in my mind, and that is Cartier. And I'm really looking forward to chatting through, you know, with Zach on that one. So, sorry, Charlie, got one more word to say?
I look forward to hearing about the Cartier.
No, exactly. I do love them. I do love them. I've got to stop buying them, but it's a naughty habit I have, but they're so beautiful. They're so beautiful. But again, thanks again, Charlie, for joining us, and thank you for keeping time with us, and over and out.